Welcome to the official SBGAN podcast, hosted by Dr. Alex Nicely.
From Petah Tikva, Israel. And if you don't have a map in your head, it's just a tad east of Tel Aviv. At Schneider Children's Medical Center, Dr. Anat Guzmark has made herself available for this recording of a podcast. Her particular interest and expertise lie in intestinal failure and its therapies, surgical short bowel syndrome, pediatric intestinal pseudoobstruction, and a variety of congenital enteropathies are among the problems that she, her patients, and her patients' families face together. There are five important questions that she's asked us to consider today. What are the common causes for chronic intestinal failure in children other than surgical short bowel syndrome? What makes pediatric intestinal pseudoobstruction or congenital enteropathies so challenging? And in that respect, do they differ in other ways from short bowel syndrome? Life-saving for patients, yes, but long-term parenteral nutrition comes with risks. And what complications should you as clinicians anticipate in your patients with these problems? What strategies are most effective in improving long-term outcomes? And indeed, what do we know about long-term outcomes and about the quality of life for these children? Are we doing them any favors, you might ask yourself. She's recommended a number of articles for more comprehensive and detailed information than any interview can present. And if you click on the appropriate link at this podcast, you'll be presented with a summary of those articles or the references to those articles and with a little summary of this introduction. But let's get right down to it and meet Dr. Guzmark. Anat, thank you for making yourself available today.
Thank you, Alex. It's lovely to be here, and thank you for this kind and comprehensive introduction of the topic.
Let's talk about common causes for chronic intestinal failure other than surgical short bowel syndrome. Is there a better reference than the 2017 New England Journal of Medicine overview that Dugan and Yakchik presented?
Well, there are many reviews and also multi-center studies that helps us to grab what's the prevalence of the different causes of intestinal failure in children. We know that short bowel syndrome or surgical short bowel syndrome is the most prevalent and the main cause of intestinal failure. We saw in this multi-center study by Aspen, published a few years ago, that 52% of pediatric intestinal failure is due to short bowel syndrome. However, 45 to 50% are because of other chronic permanent causes other than short bowel syndrome. It's interesting to see that if we look at patients beyond infancy and early childhood, they're still parenteral nutrition dependent. We actually see that most cases of adolescents with chronic intestinal failure are with conditions or due to conditions other than surgical short bowel syndrome, meaning congenital enteropathies and pseudoobstruction.
Are there differences in the incidence of chronic intestinal failure between Israel, where you work, and other countries?
That's a great question. Actually, we are not aware of any big differences. The prevalence of intestinal failure is quite similar in different countries, running from 10, 20 to 50 cases per million. Main causes of intestinal failure might differ a little bit between populations. In populations with a higher prevalence of consanguinity, for instance, we might expect more congenital diseases, inherited diseases. However, the population prevalence is quite similar to Europe and the rest of the world.
I noticed that in the references that you gave us, that none of them seems to deal particularly with surgical palliation of short bowel syndrome. So would you like in this talk to restrict ourselves to medical approaches to intestinal insufficiency?
Well, I will prefer to discuss the medical management, as surgery is very important. However, the efficacy and of surgical interventions for enhancing absorption is quite limited. There are surgeries, reconstructive surgeries, that are, of course, being done over the world, and they are specifically important in specific circumstances of short bowel syndrome, especially when the patient has a dilation or a massive dilation of the small bowel with complications such as bacterial overgrowth and malabsorption. Then the surgeries are intend to improve the anatomy and the absorption and the motility of this segment. However, it's not recommended for every case.
And transplantation is still a dream?
No, transplantation is quite important, and it's being done in Europe, in the States, in North America, and all over the world. However, the rates of intestinal and multivisceral transplantation have decreased over the past decades, because of we have seen improved prognosis of patients on intestinal on parenteral nutrition without transplantation.
As parenteral nutrition gets better.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I was wondering at the same time, as care of the prematurely born infant improves, then we'll have fewer instances of necrotizing enterocolitis or of bowel perforation, and there will be fewer surgical short bowel syndrome patients on that basis.
Well, hopefully, neonatal care is improving indeed, and there are many interesting studies and more knowledge about necrotizing enterocolitis prevention, improvement of care, and avoidance of massive resections. However, we don't see quite a decrease in the prevalence of short bowel syndrome because of necrotizing enterocolitis. Having said that, with the improved neonatal care, and we see babies that are being born more and more prematurely or survive with extreme prematurity, and therefore we see more and more cases of necrotizing enterocolitis.
So you win some,
exactly.
And you lose some.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, leaving aside surgical approaches, then pediatric intestinal pseudoobstruction and congenital enteropathies. What a mixed bag those are. but I should mention that we've talked in these podcasts with advocates of administration of intestinal growth factors. Now, that's an interesting approach, isn't it? To help the mucosa increase its surface area. Of course, as best I remember, it doesn't stay increased. You have to continue to give the agent that prompts that growth. The body isn't yet sending signals saying, we like this, keep it up. Have I got that right?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You had actually a very nice episode in this podcast with Lorenzo Norsa about teduglutide. Yeah. It's an excellent episode, and I really recommend everyone to hear that. Well, teduglutide, the GLP-2 analog, really represents the largest improvement that we have in knowledge and advance in caring for patients with intestinal failure. However, it is aimed mainly for short bowel syndrome and the improvement of gut adaptation and absorption in short bowel syndrome. There are studies about utilizing these agents also in non-surgical intestinal failure. However, it's still really preliminary right now.
And really, if you continue to, if you have rubbish enterocytes, as with microvillus inclusion disease, and you administer this agent, then you just have more rubbish enterocytes. Is that progress? Yes. I'm not sure.
I think you're right. However, teduglutide has several different effects, not only proliferation of enterocytes, but also effects on gut motility and decrease in gastric secretion and enteric secretion. So it might have some effects on the...
You try it and see if it helps. Yeah, yeah. Okay, well, when you're faced with a patient whose gut doesn't work, then I guess you grasp at straws or at glutathione. But congenital enteropathies, of course, are so challenging because lacking a mechanism for fixing the gene defect, it's just not going to get any better, is it?
Yes, that's true. Patients with congenital enteropathies are not expected to improve their absorption compared to short bowel syndrome. So we are facing a chronic, often permanent disease. Mm-hmm. However, there is much we can do in improving their lives with parenteral nutrition. And in these conditions, we have to focus on optimal growth, providing good catheter care, improving their quality of life, and just getting them grow and get ready to adulthood with parenteral nutrition. So there is much to be done besides specific therapy that I hope we will see in the future, but it's still very limited at the moment.
Long-term parenteral nutrition. That, as so often, a therapeutic intervention presents you with palliation and with another set of problems. Problems that are iatrogenic or caused by the therapy itself. And you've already touched on some of those, but take us through, cholestasis and liver fibrosis. It's not so bad a problem as it used to be, I'm certain of that, but it persists, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. Well, there are many complications that are, some of them are related to the disease, the intestinal failure, and some are related to the treatment, as you said, the parenteral nutrition or having a central venous catheter. Intestinal failure-associated liver disease is fascinating because it's multifactorial and it is related both to the intestinal failure and the lack of enteral feeding, the bacterial overgrowth in the gut, and to the parenteral nutrition effects on the liver itself. We see a decrease in the prevalence, actually, of intestinal failure-associated liver disease, probably due to better lipid emulsions with the fish oil component rich in omega-3 that have a protective effect on the liver. And also with the overall knowledge on the importance of having hours of cycling of the parenteral nutrition, like giving the liver a break to renew the antioxidative mechanisms and to improve the enteral feeding of the children. And also, when we are talking about liver damage, it is very important to prevent infections, because we know that every infectious episode, every bacteremia can harm the liver and deteriorate its function.
Yeah, tube feedings and parenteral feedings. And I don't think it's ever occurred to me before, but we know that bolus feeding in tube feeding helps preserve some of the hormonal gut and liver, gut and brain interactions that are so important.
Yeah, you're right.
Is there any work been done on bolus feeding in parenteral alimentation?
Well,
you talk about giving the liver a break, but maybe there's a little bit more to it than that.
Yeah, it's a very interesting question that you're raising. When we give parenteral nutrition, we have to be or to keep a limit of glucose delivery and also fat delivery. So this limitation is very important in order to prevent liver damage and other metabolic damages. So there's a limit of how rapid we can give the parenteral infusion. So it's quite of a delicate balance between providing the parenteral nutrition as quickly as we can in order to give the child, you know, as many hours without the infusion as we can. For many reasons, and not to cause damage with too rapid of infusion.
Oof, well, not easy to handle, not at all. We've been talking a lot in these podcasts recently about transition, about what happens when a child loses the support network that has been so important for her and her family until that point, and has to move on without her parents to negotiate health care as an adult. And this must be particularly so for patients on long-term parenteral alimentation. That's a quality of life issue that would be really difficult to address, it seems to me. Do you have transition teams in place for your patients?
Well, I'm really glad that you brought this topic up, because maybe 20 years ago, we could not have been talking about transition for a patient with intestinal failure. Since we are seeing improvement in the survival rates and the longevity with parenteral nutrition, we can now start to focus our efforts on good transition to adult care. We know from recent studies that transition readiness is really suboptimal for the children. Many of them are not prepared for transition. And there's a lot to be done in patient education, in self-management of the parenteral nutrition and the catheter hygiene. So early planning is very, very important. And also we are working on protocols for transition. We don't have really transition teams, but in the major and the big centers of intestinal failure and rehabilitation, there are transition clinic with collaboration of the adult nutritionist and gastroenterologist.
I'm really pleased that we've been able to touch on so much, and I hope that we've addressed your points well, not comprehensively, but maybe competently. And my question is, at this juncture, shortly before we have to, for reasons of time, conclude the podcast, I'd like to ask you if there's anything else that you'd like to bring up that I've overlooked.
Well, I think one of the most important aspects of caring for these complex, really complex and complicated cases is the centralization of care in specialized centers with a multidisciplinary team for intestinal failure and rehabilitation. And actually, studies have shown and have proven that referring an early referral of complex cases to centralized centers with a multidisciplinary team makes a difference. So I think this is one of the most important messages to highlight when treating chronic intestinal failure in children.
I'm sure that every country, every health system has its own approach to organizing such care and to providing the referrals from individual practitioners to these teams. That would work beautifully in the relatively compact, geographically and socially compact society that is Israel. Difficult to organize such things and to make certain that they function, but essential.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for making yourself available for these discussions. And I'd like to ask you, do you have something to contribute to our Spotify ESPGHAN playlist of favorite songs?
Yeah, I like that. Well, the song that I thought about is actually the Israeli song in the European Song Contest this year. It is called New Day Will Rise, and it's a very powerful and hopeful song about resilience and hope. And the reason I chose it is because of the singer, actually. Her name is Yuval Rafael. She's a very talented young singer and also a survivor of the Nova Music Festival, the attack on the Nova Music Festival. Oh. So it's a really hopeful and optimistic message and an example of how one can rise and thrive from difficult situations.
And which, I think, of course, applies to your patients.
Exactly. I think it's a very important message to all of us and to our patients as well.
Good luck to your patients. Good luck to you. And thanks again for being our interviewee today.
Thank you, Alex.